Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jack from Central New Jersey, and you're listening to 25 Years in 25 Days on The Brian Lehrer Show.
Today, it's 1996.
We do not need to build a bridge to the past. We need to build a bridge to the future, and that is what I commit to you to do.
This bill is a slap in the face of the Declaration of Independence. It denies gay men and women the right to liberty.
We have had word now of an explosion at the Centennial Olympic Park.
The Ag Department says Americans have really no worry about the so-called mad cow disease.
You complete me.
You had me at hello.
In 1996, Bishop Carlos Jimenez Belo and Jose Ramos Horta of East Timor won the Nobel Peace Prize. The English Patient won the Best Picture Oscar. Album of the Year at the Grammys, Jagged Little Pill by Alanis Morissette. The Dow was up 26% after rising 33% the year before. That December, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan called it irrational exuberance. The Pulitzer Prize for Fiction went to Independence Day by Richard Ford. And the following books were among those that got to number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. It Takes a Village by Hillary Clinton. Al Franken's book called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. Bloodsport by James Stewart about Wall Street deal-making. In Contempt by Christopher Darden, one of the prosecutors in the OJ trial from the year before. The Dilbert Principle by Scott Adams. And Bad as I Want to Be by Dennis Rodman. The event that we will look back on from 1996 and connect to today is something we didn't even do a segment on that year on this program because it seemed kind of remote. The Taliban came to power in Afghanistan.
They now control most of Afghanistan except for the north. President Rabbani and his military chief and loyal government soldiers have fled north about 60 kilometers out of the city. The Taliban are apparently sending soldiers in that direction to try and push them further away from the city.
Kathy Gannon from an Associated Press report, September 27, 1996. By October 8th, that was 18 years ago today, a Newsweek radio show was asking this.
How long will the Taliban hard line last? I'm Warren Levinson with Newsweek Perspective. On the one hand, the Islamic fundamentalist Taliban have taken over Afghanistan, have ended years of warfare. On the other, Afghans are trading freedom for peace, with women forced to veil themselves and stay off the streets, people being herded into mosques for prayer, movies, and even kite flying banned. On Newsweek on Air, correspondent Rod Nordland in Kabul said some in Afghanistan are hoping that the hard line will ease after the Taliban solidify their control of the country.
When they realize just how hard it's going to be, for instance, to make every man in the country grow his beard and stop all traffic five times a day for prayers, they may get more realistic. But on the other hand, that may just be wishful thinking. These are very serious, very austere men, and they haven't shown much sign of compromise in the past.
Nordland says it's true women found in the streets have been beaten, but some see the fact that none of them have been seriously hurt as a hopeful sign. It remains to be seen whether they're deluding themselves. I'm Warren Levinson.
So the news was out there in 1996 about the Taliban's extreme rule. Sounds eerily like ISIS today, doesn't it? But there wasn't much public awareness in this country. Afghanistan had not mattered to U.S. foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. Our government mostly ignored it. So did this program. We even ignored it after CNN got this interview in 97 in an undisclosed Afghanistan location with a little-known leader who had declared jihad against the United States. His name was Osama bin Laden. The CNN correspondent was Peter Arnett.
Mr. bin Laden, you have declared a jihad against the United States. Can you tell us why?
The U.S. government has committed acts that are extremely unjust, hideous, and criminal through its support of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And we believe the U.S. is directly responsible for those killed in Palestine, Lebanon, and Iraq. Due to its subordination to the Jews, the arrogance of the United States regime has reached the point that they occupied Arabia, the holiest place of the Muslims, who are more than a billion people in the world today. For this and other acts of aggression and injustice, we have declared jihad against the U.S.
Is the jihad directed against the U.S. government or United States troops in Arabia? What about U.S. civilians in Arabia or the people of the United States.
We have focused our declaration of jihad on striking at the U.S. soldiers inside Arabia, the country of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina. In our religion, it is not permissible for any non-Muslim to stay in Arabia. Therefore, even though American civilians are not targeted in our plan, they must leave. We do not guarantee their safety.
Osama bin Laden, through a translator, obviously, in his first TV interview, as he was protected by the Taliban in an undisclosed location in Afghanistan 4 years before the September 11th attacks. And listening to that, wasn't that a prescient question by CNN's Peter Arnett in 1997, whether Osama bin Laden intended to attack U.S. civilians in the United States? But interesting, too, that the answer at that time, at least, if we can believe that that was his intent at that time, was no, only in Saudi Arabia and not specifically against civilians. So let's look back and connect it all to today. Sarah Shays was an NPR foreign correspondent from 1996 to 2002. She covered Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion, and she left journalism to live in Kandahar and work locally with an NGO. After 2002, she wrote the book The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban, published in 2006. She has been a special advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and is now senior associate with the Democracy and Rule of Law Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Hi, Sarah Shays. So nice to see you. It's
great
been like
to see
a
you,
decade.
Brian. Yeah.
Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And we're so lucky that you're in New York today. When did you first get to Kandahar, which was kind of the Taliban capital of Afghanistan,
right,
rather than Kabul, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I'll even wind it back closer to 96. I first started thinking about Afghanistan at all. I was covering the civil war in Algeria, which also is kind of part of the story. I don't know if you even remember it, but in the mid-90s to about 1998, it was what's called the Black Years in Algeria. And, you know, a jihadi group was cutting people's heads off
we
in
did
villages.
We did cover that one on the show. At least
so,
I can say that.
Yeah. And so I was there on a trip, and someone said something really curious to me. It was, the story's not here anymore. This story of violent political Islam has moved to Afghanistan. And I remember doing the kind of click, click, click in my brain because, you know, I'm the Paris correspondent. Can I get to Afghanistan? It was like, nope, NPR cuts up the world that way. So I kind of put it out of my mind. And then not, you know, 4 years later, I was riding into Kandahar in, I think it was December 9th, 2001. So just after Kabul had fallen, maybe it was a day or two after Kandahar fell.
September 9th?
Sorry, December 9th.
December 9th. Right. So the beginning of the post 9/11 U.S.
That's exactly
invasion.
Right. That's exactly right. And I was riding in from Quetta, Pakistan. I remember in a yellow taxi, which Pakistani taxis were yellow, and the driver I had was terrified to drive into Afghanistan with this yellow taxi because he knew it would be seen as a Pakistani one.
What kind of society did you find in Kandahar?
It was really interesting. It was a battened-down city. You could feel you didn't have, you know, explosions of joy and rapture at the incoming internationals.
Liberation, as you like to see it.
But you didn't have rejection either. I never experienced a sort of visceral rejection of me in 10 years of living in that town. Never experienced a sort of visceral rejection of me as a denizen of Western civilization or anything like that. What you had was people who had been through a lot of really violent changes, and they were like turtles with their heads and feet pulled into their houses. And so you came into this city that was somehow silent and ghost-like. It's on a plain with some very jagged hills immediately to the north, so it's very austere landscape. And a lot of the buildings are made of mud brick, and so it kind of fades into the landscape. And then you had these pickup trucks, Toyota pickup trucks of anti-Taliban militia, the very people that the Taliban had defeated back in 1994 and 1996, who were sweeping back into town on the heels of the American military effort, and they were riding around town. You know, they had rocket launchers lashed to their pickup trucks.
And those were not exactly good guys either, right? I mean, I think the initial story, when I went back and did a lot of reading last night for this, the initial New York Times story when the Taliban came to power was not about repression of women or, you know, all this other horrible stuff. It was about peace.
Right.
After years and years of civil war.
So here's – and it's an imperfect – the rise of the Taliban back then is an imperfect analogy with ISIS in Iraq now, but it's not a false one. And I think what ties the two together is the issue of governance. We keep having this sort of fantasy, kind of self-gratifying fantasy that, you know, oh, those people out there, they're really not ready for democracy. They're not ready, you know, they don't want democracy. You know, basically, we're the only ones good enough for democracy. I think both of these stories really show how false that is. It's not that Afghans in 1994 or 1996 were looking for democracy in the Taliban, but they were looking for governance. And I have to say that in all the years I lived there, and increasingly as time went on, people started ranking the Taliban as a better government than us, not over religious ideological reasons, but over how the place was governed. And in fact, when I first arrived in Kandahar in, as I said, December of 2001, what people were telling me was, initially, the Taliban weren't so bad. It's when the, quote, Arab Taliban, which is how they at that time were talking about bin Laden and his crowd, when they came to Kandahar and began taking control over the election, government, what the people were telling me was then we didn't have access anymore. They weren't listening to us. They weren't taking into consideration the views of our elders. So in a weird way, it is still about democracy insofar as that means real participation by people through their chosen representatives and how they're being governed. And you look at ISIS in Iraq, I mean, quote, ISIS-controlled territory isn't controlled by crazy ISIS jihadis entirely. It's controlled about 20% by those guys and about 80% by Sunnis, be they former Ba'athists, be they Sunni civilians, be they Sunni tribal leaders, who are just at their wits' end about how to get any kind of penetration, any kind of participation in the government that we established in Baghdad.
That the Shiite majority ran roughshod over with because the government in Baghdad just wasn't taking the needs of the Sunnis into account.
And I'd say beyond calling it even the Shiite majority, what I've noticed as I've been studying, I've been in the last couple of years really looking carefully at places where religious extremism emerges from what I'm calling kleptocratic governance. What's so fascinating is, let's take Afghanistan under Karzai. It wasn't Karzai's tribe that was ruling. I knew lots of Karzai's tribe members who were victims too. It's a network. So back to the Shiite majority, it wasn't the Shiite majority that was making out under Maliki. It was a network of Maliki cronies that were basically treating the state, the government, Iraq, as a source of revenue. And those situations very frequently provoke militant puritanical religious responses.
Kleptocracy.
Yes.
Leads to religious fanaticism.
It can. And going all the way back, I don't want to take us too far back in history beyond 1996, but as I was looking into this, I discovered that sort of constitutionalism, which, big discovery, right, which was one way of getting around kleptocracy, right, providing recourse in a kleptocratic situation. Lots of Protestants, you know, the Dutch Revolt, the English Civil War, the American Constitution. So I've said, golly, I better go read some Martin Luther. Guess what?
They were pretty puritanical, too.
And it was about corruption. What was Martin Luther going after? He was going after indulgences and simony and the corruption of the Catholic Church system, and they were pretty extreme and pretty puritanical.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, our anniversary series, 25 years and 25 days. Today, 1996, hooked to the Taliban rise to power in Afghanistan that year, ignored by most of America, ignored by this program. And by the way, something to stay tuned for. I won't tip you off as to what it is. In 1999, we ignored another story that will be our focus of our show 3 days from now. And if there are any people from Afghanistan listening right now, in Afghanistan right now on the web, or Afghan Americans here who want to reflect on any of this, the meaning of the Taliban over all this time for your country, the meaning of the Taliban for the United States, the prehistory, did the United States ignore Afghanistan too much after the Cold War? And that set the stage for this. Whatever you want to say, the relationship between that then and ISIS now. Wasn't Sarah Shays, former NPR correspondent, fascinating on that a minute ago? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. The stuff we heard in that 1996 Newsweek report, that a reason for hope was that women beaten just for being on the streets were not seriously injured. Oh, my God. Did the Taliban pull back on that extreme rule once they consolidated power in the late 90s, as that report wondered if they would?
Not in the area that I'm most familiar with, which is Kandahar, which really was their heartland. And it was, as a matter of fact, one of the women who worked in my cooperative was telling me she had put henna on her fingernails, basically like nail polish. And she was looking at a pair of shoes, I think, and one of their kind of – they would have people roaming the streets with sticks who would beat people for not, you know, abiding by some of these strictures. And he slammed her hand as she put her hand out on the counter. And she told me about running away, and even the old shoes she had on her feet she lost as she was running away. I do remember the men in my cooperative saying that the 5 times a day herding people off the streets into mosques, that didn't really hold, largely because in order to pray in Islam, you have to have done a ritual ablution. You have to wash your hands and face and feet in a particular way. And if you pray without having done so, it's almost sinful. And so it doesn't really work to herd people into a mosque if you don't know whether they've done their ablution.
So after the September 11th attacks in 2001, there was all this hand-wringing that I recall in the foreign affairs establishment and in the media about how the U.S. blew it by ignoring Afghanistan during all those years after the Cold War, after the Soviet invasion was defeated in the late 80s. Do you think, with this much hindsight, that the U.S. could have prevented the rise of the Taliban there?
Here's what I'd say more broadly. It's really hard to argue backwards that way, but I do think there is a systematic refusal to examine and acknowledge the importance of governance in these type of phenomena. So we tend to see things really in military terms. So once the Soviets militarily pulled out of Afghanistan, we thought that was the end of the story. And of course, it's not. When there's a dramatic change of regime that way, you have to – something has to fill a vacuum. And I think, again, to bring it to the present, the same insight applies to both Afghanistan and Iraq today. So how have we thought about consolidating those two countries that we invaded? We've exclusively thought about the military, almost exclusively. It's been about training, equipping, and raising the capacity and capability of two militaries. And what's happened with ISIS in Iraq has proven how short-sighted that view is. A military is only an arm in the hand of a government. And if you don't focus on how a government is constituted, that's the basis for both stability and flourishing of a country.
So this program finally did a Taliban segment in March of 2001. It was 6 months before 9/11, after the Taliban outraged the world anew by destroying a group of Buddhist statues, the Buddhas of Bamiyan.
Okay, so statues. Let's just remind people what
understand.
That means, right? These things are the size of a mountain.
And we talked about the Taliban's horrific treatment of human beings as well. Finally, in that segment that was triggered by this global outrage about the statues the size of a mountain, here is the very end of that segment with Thomas Gauthier, director of the Center for Afghan Studies at the University of Nebraska. I asked him if there is anything the U.S. should do at that stage in March 2001.
I think at this stage there isn't much to be done other than to remind our government that we need to really move on the Pakistanis to stop the type of support that they're providing the Taliban, which only perpetuates them in this kind of joint venture that the Pakistanis and Osama bin Laden, Saudi Arabia, have to sustain the Taliban in power.
Thomas Gauthier is the director of the Center for Afghan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Thank you very much.
You bet.
By the way, we just tweeted a video of the destruction of those statues. If people want to see the visuals, at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. But that show excerpt from March 7th, 2001, Afghanistan expert Professor Gauthier. And by the way, that's how obscure Afghanistan was as a policy discussion area in the United States at that time. The biggest expert that we could find was at the University of Nebraska.
But he did put his finger on a really critical issue, which is the role of Pakistan, which we still haven't gotten our heads around. We still didn't figure out that Pakistan and continues to be basically supporting the insurgents that we have been fighting against in Afghanistan.
And not only did he mention Pakistan, the way he put it in that clip was that Pakistan and Osama bin Laden were keeping the Taliban in power rather than the other way around, them protecting him as the U.S. framed it after 9/11.
And did you hear him say that Pakistan and Osama bin Laden were in a joint venture? So remember all this business about Pakistan didn't know where he was hiding? I don't believe it.
Let's take a phone call. Hamed, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Good show. I'm an African-American, and calling you from the city, and certainly I do relate to everything you're saying in here, and the lady is very informed. And the problem is that historically has been the problem that we're trying to solve one problem by creating another problem. And until we stop the cycle, people will pay heavy prices. And then as you're correctly pointing out, Afghan people paid a whole lot of high prices from the Russian invasion, and after that, defeating the Russians, and based on the job was done, the Americans kind of said, all right, we're done here, let's move. And
what would you like, this is to my question before about whether the U.S., through continued involvement after the Cold War, could have prevented the rise of the Taliban and, by extension, 9/11, if we want to take it to that. But what do you think the United States could have done, Hamed, if you're echoing that sentiment?
I think that just ignoring any kind of fundamentalism is going to lead to that kind of uncontrolled environment. I think the signs were there, and I think the Americans were not that naive, but not understanding fundamentalism, 15, 20 years ago.
Hamed, thank you very much for your call. So, Sarah Shays, your 2006 book was about Afghanistan after Taliban rule. Yeah, are you laughing because it's not really after Taliban
rule
yet?
Yeah, that was a little bit of a premature subtitle, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. And they were, by the time it came out, it was starting to get hot again in Kandahar. But it's pretty interesting to me that I still felt that I could write that subtitle. I didn't quite realize how significant resurgence there was going to be. And frankly, it's for the same reason. So what I'd say is that the Taliban resurgence, even more than their initial conquest, if you will, of most of Afghanistan, is much more similar to the ISIS story in Iraq, in that what we put in place, what the United States put in place in Afghanistan was, I'm going to be a little provocative here, but was something like a vertically integrated criminal organization that was masquerading as a government. We called it a democratic government, but it really was much more concerned and effective at maximizing revenues. And golly gee, you have a population that's actually willing to say these crazy fundamentalist jihadis are no worse for me than my own government. And that's what Iraqi Sunnis have been saying.
So in your post-journalism Afghanistan career, you went on to serve as an advisor to the top generals there, including McChrystal and Petraeus. Did they get this?
I would say they did. And the person who got it the best was the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, whom I also worked for, Mike Mullen. But it was really interesting to watch how difficult it was to push this approach. So when you had the famous 2009 long debate about Afghanistan policy, it was all about how many men and women in uniform were going to go where to do what. It was, is it going to be 20,000 or is it going to be 41,000? You know, and nobody really said, if we don't focus on the governance issues, it doesn't matter if you send a million soldiers in there. And you had the military pushing civilian leadership. Can we please talk about something other than just the military aspects of this?
So now there's a new government in Afghanistan. Do you see them as any less of a kleptocracy, any better at governance, at least potentially?
Joint venture. It's an elite bargain, and so many positions, lucrative positions, have basically been sold for support that, unfortunately, I think what you might have is instead of one kleptocratic network, you're going to have two rival kleptocratic networks running the place.
So will the Taliban rise again if too many U.S. troops go home? That's the debate that's taking place in Washington right now, especially in light of how they say that may have led to the power of ISIS in Iraq today. Or is that the wrong question based on what you just said?
Right. So they are rising. And yes, ongoing U.S. troop presence could stem that flow to some extent, but to what end? If there's never a concerted focus on how you get the government to be at least minimally acceptable to its citizens, then it's a recipe for just keeping troops in there forever.
Then you must think that President Obama is right, and he's taken so much guff from the Republicans about this, to try to resist sending troops into Iraq and Syria again, or airstrikes, until they get the Iraqi government right and they finally force Maliki out.
I do, but there's still been a limit. Just saying no military, no use of force, doesn't equate to putting the energy into the non-military side that he ought to be doing. So instead of running around creating a new coalition to bomb people that Secretary Kerry has been doing, why is Kerry not getting an international coalition together to try to work out the shape of devolution of power in Iraq? How can Sunni areas be more autonomous and governed in a way that they feel that they've got access to how they're being governed, access to some of the oil wealth? What about the Kurds? Why are we not buying oil from the Kurds? I mean, that's the sort of diplomatic effort that should be going on that use of force could support. And instead, we've got diplomacy in support of the use of force.
Fascinating. And with history from 18 years ago, so relevant to today, as we've been hearing from Sarah Shea, former NPR foreign affairs correspondent, now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Brian.
And that's 25 years in 25 days for today. Tomorrow, 1997, the year Ellen DeGeneres came out on television. We'll talk to her mom, Betty DeGeneres. And we close for today, as we've been doing, with the Billboard number one song of the year. So what was America doing while ignoring the rise of the Taliban in 1996? Dancing the Macarena. Dala tu cuerpo alegría Macarena, que tu cuerpo es pa dar la alegría y cosa buena. Dala tu cuerpo alegría Macarena, Macarena. Dala tu cuerpo alegría Macarena, que tu cuerpo es pa dar la alegría y cosa buena. Dala tu cuerpo alegría Macarena, Macarena.